Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
For the last couple of weeks, we've been exploring the key addictions that many of us are falling prey to. Overeating, overshopping, technology, social media, alcohol, just to name a few. They impact our lifestyle, our relationships, undermine our beliefs and value in ourselves. However, I'd be less than candid if I didn't confess right now, this next conversation may well apply to me, and quite possibly to you. Addiction to work. Here are some questions for you to consider before we continue. Do you take your work home, to bed, to holidays, on weekends? Do you believe that it's okay to work long hours if you love what you're doing? Have you ever said, I have no choice, my boss makes me work these hours, or alternatively, if I wasn't there, the place would fall down around me? Well, relax. While you may be a workaholic, you're not alone. And our next guest, a member of the Melbourne chapter of Workaholics Anonymous, we'll call Pamela, can prove not only work addiction exists, but that you can break free. Pamela, welcome to Open House. Share a little of your life before you became a recovering workaholic.
Look, Duane, my weeks have always been absolutely full on, driven and striving and having to achieve and produce was pretty common. Sort of way back a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago, it would be nothing for me to work from 8:30 in the morning till 2 a.m. Lunch breaks were just, nothing like that was in my consciousness at all. Going back 10 years before that, in my early 20s, I had a full-time job which was sort of 8:30 to 5:30. And then I had a weekend job as well. So it was very common to have two or three jobs as a workaholic. And a lot of workaholics will have their own business because that enables you to work non-stop.
Pamela, take us back to that dark night of the soul, as you call it, February last year.
I had an epiphany February last year. And I guess driven by mental and physical exhaustion, I could no longer keep pushing myself. And I had a breakdown. But as a beautiful girlfriend told me at the time, it was actually the breakthrough of a lifetime. I'd been carrying and playing out this workaholism for about 30 years, I would say, with absolutely no understanding of that's what it was. I mean, workaholism at that stage in February 2013, it just wasn't a word in my lexicon. It wasn't an understanding. And, I mean, it is amazing what we can kind of avoid or deny before that veil of illusion lifts. But I had this epiphany that I was a workaholic, and I sat down and I wrote, my name is Pamela and I'm a workaholic, which is kind of interesting because in a 12-step program, that is exactly what we say. It was extremely painful, but it was, a fabulous realization because with insight and awareness can come healing and recovery.
As dawn rose that next day, what did you do then?
So I'm a bit of a researcher. I jumped on Google, good old Dr. Google, and I typed in workaholism, and I was very fortunate, Duane, in that one of the first websites I came across was Workaholics Anonymous, the American organization, or the American website. And what's really interesting was there was like a little quiz there that you can take, and it contains 20 questions. Something around, are you a workaholic, or these are the signs of what a workaholic is. I answered yes to 17 of those questions out of the 20. I ticked all of them. And I guess, a little bit more lighthearted now, I can look back and have a bit of a chuckle about it. But the only reason I didn't tick the other three were that my workaholism over the previous 10 years had saw me get very ill, and I have chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia as a result of my workaholism. So I couldn't tick those three questions because the illness and my state of health wouldn't allow me to do those three things anymore. And like one of them was, do you work more than 40 hours a week? Well, I can't. I haven't been able to for some time. Thank God is all I can say.
Pamela, in exploring addictions in this series, we found that a great many of them are visited upon us because of a lack of self-worth or feelings of personal failure. Was that the case in your experience?
Look, I came from a very chaotic and dysfunctional family, and that's not to blame my parents or any of that. I mean, as a child, children need to be loved more than anything else. They need to know that they're okay. I didn't get any of that reaffirmation or confirmation of being okay or being enough just as I was. So to me, my workaholism and my constant need for activity is a way of playing that out. It's, if I'm busy, I don't have to look at those feelings. I don't have to look at what's going on. By keeping myself busy, I avoid all of that messy, yucky stuff, as I call it.
Did friends and family look at you devolving into this work addict and suggest to you either softly or perhaps more overtly as time went by that this is a problem? You're not being right for you and you're not being right for us as family and friends.
Well, no, because it's an acceptable addiction. It really is. And I mean, it's very fine line sometimes between, are you just working hard? Are you just a high achiever? Or have you crossed that line and are you a workaholic? And I always just saw myself as a high achiever, someone who sets high standards. If I wasn't working, I was studying. If I wasn't studying, I was exercising. And I think that's the thing. Workaholism is progressive, definitely. And so the epiphany last year in February was where I absolutely, my addiction had run its course and I suppose in a way it couldn't get any worse. But, you know, coming from a dysfunctional family too and not having those close relationships, perhaps because of my workaholism over the years, means that people don't see it as it really is as well. And you can rationalise it because it is a socially accepted condition.
Pamela, in your experience, to what extent is work addiction actually an addiction to activity?
Look, I think they're one and the same thing. It's just that I play out my addiction is played out through workaholism. I have previously played out through other activities. I've been a dietaholic. I've been an exerciseaholic. I've even named myself as a people pleaseraholic. Because that's definitely part of it. Not sure if I have answered that question very clearly there, but yeah, it's definitely workaholism. It doesn't just occur in the workspace, but for me and for us workaholics, I guess, that's where we play it out. A lot of people who come into Workaholics Anonymous, the program, will have played it out in study. There's a lot of obsessive compulsive studiers out there.
Okay.
And again, this comes back to it being an acceptable social addiction, because we just see people as, oh my God, they're high achievers, aren't they fantastic?
Yeah.
You know, they're amazing, they've done 4 degrees. When in actual fact, it's a real major emotional and mental problem.
You mentioned the Workaholics Anonymous support groups. What was your first visit to one of these groups like?
Oh my God, it felt amazing. It just felt like I wasn't alone. It felt like I wasn't, you know, so I knew that there was help available. I think that was it. I was very, very I was very emotional when I went into Workaholics Anonymous for my first meeting. It was very excruciatingly painful. One thing I do remember is that they didn't have a box of tissues. And I suggested not long after that perhaps we should have a box of tissues for people who come in. But look, you know, knowing that you're not alone, knowing that what you're experiencing, you are quite insane, really, when you come into Workaholics Anonymous, but knowing that there is a place for to get rid of that insanity and develop some serenity and sanity. And that's what Workaholics Anonymous, that meeting, this 1 hour or so a week, it's a fellowship, you know, a fellowship of people who have had your experiences, who can offer you strength and hope that there is a place and space for recovery to occur.
How do workaholics find time to attend a Workaholics Anonymous meeting?
Yes. Well, you have to actually surrender. You have to, firstly, as the first step of any 12-step program says, you have to admit that you're powerless over your addiction and that your life has become unmanageable. And, you know, again, going back to addiction as a progressive disease, my life had become so totally unmanageable. You know, I'd already had developed chronic fatigue, but kept running for another 10 years with chronic fatigue. The high comes from the adrenaline hit, and particularly if you have got lots of deadlines, as most workaholics will, you've got lots of stuff on, you've got an incredibly jam-packed diary, because that then gives you a sense of, a sense of misguided self, but a sense of self because you don't have an authentic one. I'm busy, I have a lot on, I must be okay, I must be important, okay, lovable, all those kind of things.
Looking back, you now know that that language is not healthy, not normal behaviour, for the want of a better term.
Yeah.
What are some of the other behaviours that, since being a part of Workaholics Anonymous, you've identified as unhealthy behaviours?
So here's another one that I found fascinating. As a workaholic, you don't do self-care. So a classic day for me previously, I'd go into one of my clients, I'd get in at 9:30, say, because I'm self-employed, so I can work my own hours. But I would go absolutely at 170% all day, no lunch break. I would hold off going to the toilet. Now, I mean, doesn't that sound ridiculous?
Yeah.
But that is just not even in your consciousness. You're just so hyper-focused on what you're achieving. Your whole thing is about outcomes-based. No lunch break, no understanding or ability even to be able to say to a colleague, let's go and have lunch, because you don't know how to do those things anyway. So, self-care was absolutely not on the horizon at all, which means, you know, you have impacts on health. Another little thing might be having a bottle of water on your desk. You avoid getting up and getting a drink, just as you avoid getting up and having toilet breaks or lunch breaks.
Pamela, one of the key principles of the Workaholics Anonymous program is abstinence. How does one abstain from working?
Yeah, look, again, another good question, and I guess it's a bit like Overeaters Anonymous and people who overeat. You can't abstain from food. You can't abstain from work. For me, I had to find what my balance is, and, you know, I've had calls with other workaholics and outreach to people. I think you really need to look, it's hard for us workaholics to get a sense of perspective as what's normal for a normal person. Now, my normal for me has been very little work in the beginning stages because I'm also healing from chronic fatigue. So my thing for me is 4 hours a day of work, 4 days a week. It will look different for different people and depending on people's financial situations as well. But balance has to be a mix of rest and recreation, downtime, work, friendships, relationships. You know, it's got to be, I guess, a schedule. I hate to use the word schedule because that sounds workaholic, but it has to be a schedule that includes all of those things. Oh, and the important one, I forgot, play and playfulness.
There'll be some listening right now who will, perhaps as a defence mechanism, be yelling at the radio, Pamela saying, well, hang on, I'm not my own boss. You were. My boss expects me to do these crazy hours. I'm supposed to be available 18 hours a day. And when I'm not at work, I should have my phone by my bedside to make sure I don't miss any email.
Yes, well, look, I'm going to say I'd like to ask those viewers to question where those directives or where those understandings are really coming from. And I've had this conversation with other friends who have said to me, but you don't get it, you know, I have to work 50 hours a week or I'll lose my job. And it is something I have written about as well. I responded to someone's blog the other week about, you know, Australia has become a bit of a, or Australians have become very, it's almost expected, the norm, that's the word I'm looking for, it's almost the norm that we feel we have to work more than 40 hours a week. And, you know, to me it's an issue of boundaries. We need to be constantly reassessing boundaries and really looking at where these directives are coming from. Are they really coming from our boss, or are we not just standing up to our employers and job situations? Are we not having boundaries around them?
Pamela, you consider yourself a recovering workaholic. What does recovery look like in your life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, recovery is being able to, as I said, you've surrendered, you've accepted. Things like, I guess, you underschedule instead of overschedule. So underscheduling might be, for instance, you don't take on another activity unless you've checked it with someone in your fellowship or you've substituted. So you'll only take on a new activity or put something new in the diary if something else goes. That's a very hard one for workaholics to do. You become more playful, definitely more relaxed in situations. there's no longer this focus, this all-consuming, all-encompassing focus on work. So previously, if I can give an example, I spoke constantly about work, I thought constantly about work, every idea was about how I could work or do something with my work or what could I be, what could I create or produce. You start to find that those thoughts no longer fill your mind. You take an interest in other people, in what's happening with them. You become a more holistic person yourself. You give up multitasking. That's a big one. I've become a single tasker, as I call it, Duane. And look, it's such a more serene pace that you work at, that you live at. And the real big one for me, the one I love, is that I've stopped being a human doing and I've become a human being, probably for the first time in my life.
Pamela, as we celebrate your newfound human beingness, what's been the response from family and friends who perhaps in the early days couldn't get through to you or perhaps had reinforced positively your workaholism before? What are they saying to you and with you now?
Look, certainly from my husband's perspective, he says, you know, I'm just so much more calm and relaxed, and he's just so happy that I'm not sick all the time because, you know, I would work all week, caffeine to keep me going, you know, medication or alcohol of a night to slow me down. I had chronic insomnia, so weekends were just completely him caring for me and me in bed because I was sick. So he's so delighted that I'm, you know, a little bit normal these days and that we can have a normal social life. You know, we go out and do things. I'm not bedridden on weekends. I'm not cranky all the time because I'm not overworking. Girlfriends have noticed that I no longer talk just about work all the time. But having said that too, I haven't divulged to a lot of people that I am in Workaholics Anonymous, because while it may be a socially accepted addiction, it's not necessarily something that's easy to talk about. There's a couple of close friends I've shared with, and a girlfriend said to me last night, she said, you never cease to amaze me about, you know, how what you do in life and your inner learnings and development. Family, not so much. I haven't spoken to them a lot about it because, again, it might be socially acceptable, but it's not so easy to talk about it. And coming from a dysfunctional family anyway, it's not a close family situation. But what I've noticed is that I'm much more stronger in standing up for my boundaries and I'm no longer people-pleasing. That doesn't necessarily mean everyone will come on board with you. So as a friend or a colleague said to me, there will be casualties as you recover from workaholism.
Pamela, thanks so much for sharing your insights into workaholism so candidly. It's been a confronting conversation, I'll be honest. I could tick more than one or two of the boxes that you ticked along the way to your recovering from workaholism. We'll post a link to Workaholics Anonymous on our webpage, openhousecommunity.com.au.
Thanks, Duane, and it's a pleasure, and I hope people call out for help who need it.
For Greg Foister, taking that first step away from work was one step away from being work addicted. He was kicking big-time goals as an advertising guy and then realised that he was selling stuff he didn't actually believe in. So he broke free. He packed a bag, mounted a push bike, and headed up Australia's east coast to connect with people who had successfully reset their lives from their own work addictions. Greg, welcome to Open House. Did you consider yourself a workaholic?
At the time when I was in advertising, absolutely, just simply because the level of work that I was doing, the number of hours, was detrimental to my health and my relationships.
Why?
Well, it was starting to tear apart the relationship that I had. It was actually counterproductive. I was less efficient as a result of spending so many hours at work, and my whole identity was tied up in what I did, and I think that's unhealthy for anyone.
The difficulty about Australian workers is that we tend to deify people who put in stupid hours.
Yeah, we do. It's strange, isn't it? Because often those people aren't really working very efficiently. I think we should deify the people who get up, go to the gym, do some sort of exercise, put in a healthy 6 or 7 hours of really efficient, high-quality work, and then go home. But actually, we seem to respect those who work the ridiculously long hours, even if they're not working productively.
I can't remember a lot about what I was doing specifically in 2008, but you're pretty clear about one day in particular where you had a panic attack. How did that happen?
Yeah, so I had been working in the advertising industry for about 5 years, and I was struggling with, an existential crisis, because at the same time as promoting highly inefficient cars through ads, I was researching climate change, and I had a bit of a moral dilemma. I realised that it was very high levels of consumption in countries like Australia that was the root cause of ecological problems, and I felt part of that problem simply because I was working in advertising. And eventually all this boiled over, and I had to leave my job simply due to not believing in the ethics of it anymore. And once I left my job, I just broke down. I had no sense of identity anymore. I was clueless about who I really was without that role, that job title. And so I did end up having a panic attack and going to a hospital. And afterwards, it took me a very long time to rebuild my identity around something other than my work.
When did Sophie, your girlfriend, propose the idea of pedalling up the east coast of Australia as, in part, a solution?
Yeah, so that was a couple of years later. What we were doing was we were looking to explore simpler and more sustainable ways to live that offered an alternative to that kind of high-consumption lifestyle that I promoted in advertising. And we decided if we were going to look at simple and sustainable ways to live, we should use a simple and sustainable mode of transport, which was the bicycle. All good in theory, but at the time we weren't cyclists. So, in fact, I cycled all the way to Brisbane without knowing bike shorts were supposed to be worn without underwear. And I had some silky boxes on underneath and ended up with some rather painful blisters.
And you weren't really campers either when you commenced this journey.
My longest time in a tent was 3 days at a music festival, and you can imagine that camping for basically 6-7 months came as a bit of a shock to us. So we were on a budget of about $10 a day, which of course forces you to live simply, which is kind of the point of the whole journey.
Greg, you're pretty candid in your book about why it was that you didn't pull out of workaholism earlier in your life, and one of the key reasons was that you didn't know how to start. So you set out to meet people who had. Tell us about some of those folks.
The first person who stood out for us was a man, an architect who built a tiny house the size of a backyard shed. So it was about 10 square metres, and it's very small. But the reason he stood out for us so much was he reminded me of the philosophies of Henry David Thoreau, who wrote the book Walden about the 2 years and 2 months he spent living in a pond in Concord, Massachusetts. And Thoreau's philosophy was that you always need to consider the time that you spend on something, not the money. So he has this quote where he writes, "The cost of a thing is the amount of what I will call life, which is required to be exchanged for it." And this architect we met had the same philosophy when it came to housing. He said, "Look, you could spend, you can own a really big expensive house, but you have to realise that you're trading off decades of your life to pay for it. And I choose to own a very, very small house so that I have more free time." And this really got to the heart of what owning possessions is all about. It's essentially a trade-off. And if you choose to have less, then you often end up with more free time.
Once you'd begun the simplification process, Greg, and you and Sophie were on the road, how did having that extra space in your head and your heart change your relationships with Sophie and with other people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess with Sophie, we became very, very strong as a couple. We were like a team overcoming adversity. I don't know how else to describe it. We just worked together and we learnt to argue through our differences. We learnt to forgive each other when we fell short. We just became very, very strong as a couple. In terms of like the space that comes from cycling, what happens is that a lot of your worries just dissipate if you're spending all your time on the road, outdoors, getting lots of exercise, but also focusing on the necessities of life. I mean, our thoughts were occupied with, where are we going to sleep tonight? Where are we going to get food? Where are we going to get water? how far we're going to travel. And these could seem like worrying things because they're to do with survival, but it's also incredibly liberating to focus on the necessities of life and to actually spend time considering those simpler things, I suppose.
I also get the sense in reading your book that the self-sufficiency that drives the heart of many workaholics dissipates pretty quickly when you're dependent on the generosity of others.
Yes, self-reliance or self-sufficiency is ultimately an impossible ideal. You can never be your own little isolated kingdom and expect to be able to do everything for yourself. And in fact, I'd argue that the individualism that's crept across our society is really mentally damaging for a lot of people. And I say that after having lived in an intentional community, which is essentially somewhere where people choose to cooperate and share belongings. And it's just fantastic. You get to really know your neighbours, and I've felt so much better as a person since living in a real community.
Greg, I was fascinated by the paradox of your meeting with a man in Canberra who had done a great deal of study around people who were downshifting or breaking out of the workaholism cycle in their own lives. Tell us about him.
Yeah, that was just one person. It was Clive Hamilton, who is an Australian academic and author and wrote one of the original studies into downshifting in Australia in 2003. And we went to visit him in his office, and I asked him about, you know, his own work habits, and he said that he worked 9 to 10 hours a day for 5 days a week. But then he said, look, downshifting is not necessarily about working fewer hours. It's actually about voluntarily reducing your income. So you're placing other values ahead of earning money. That's what downshifting is really about. And so if you went from a really high-flying corporate job to something in the voluntary sector or something that's related to your passions, you might end up working more hours than you did before, but technically you'd still be downshifting because you'd take a lower income and you would be doing what made you happy. You'd be putting your values ahead of it. Simply earning money.
Greg, there are mums and dads right now listening to this conversation, reacting something like, well, congratulations, Greg, you rode up the east coast of Australia to break free. I've got a mortgage, kids in school, paying off a car, that credit card debt. I've got commitments.
A couple of things. I guess the first thing is that we did meet a lot of people with kids who'd chosen to downshift or live more simply. And in fact, a lot of Australians have made that choice. So in Clive's original study in 2003, he found that nearly a quarter of Australians in their 30s, 40s and 50s downshifted in the preceding 10 years. And the Australian Bureau of Statistics has found one-fifth of Australians want to work fewer hours for less pay. So a lot of us are willing to trade our money for more time, which is essentially what downshifting is. And it doesn't have to mean upping stumps and moving to a rural property. In fact, some people who have done that have found that they've traded one rat race for another. They've suddenly found themselves spending a lot of time, you know, in the orchard or in the garden, to the point where they're just working as hard as they did before. And so one lesson that we learnt on the road was that came from a woman in the Sunshine Coast, and she said, bloom where you are planted. I love that phrase, bloom where you are planted. In other words, you're often better off just staying in your current situation and tweaking it slightly to give yourself more time and you know, more space to spend enjoying yourself rather than trying to make some radical life change.
So, Greg, if we wrap up our conversation this afternoon with some of the key findings in your book, breaking free of workaholism can start with realigning our lives with what we do outside of our workplace, changing our social networks to support our life choices, and what else?
Well, a key point of living more simply is to live your values, and that means focusing on what's important to you and then removing any clutter in your life that doesn't help you reach those values. So that can sometimes mean owning less, but there's always a trade-off involved in owning less. You often get more time or more space. In fact, in the Simple Living movement, there's this idea of growth by subtraction. I love that, growth by subtraction. When you take something away, you often leave space for yourself to grow in other ways. And I guess the other phrase that I'd like to include is work with what you've got. And that gets back to the idea I was talking about before, where it doesn't have to be a radical change. It can just be you staying in the same situation that you were before, but perhaps altering it just slightly, so you get a little more time to spend with your family and you're a little less worried about career.
Greg, it was a fun read. Thank you for the book. It was a challenging one as well, as I realised that some of the things I was laughing at in you are in fact present in my life. And thanks for your insights into breaking free of workaholism in our lives.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.